Welcome to The Good Manners Map with me, Monique Chambers, where we take a journey around the world learning about social etiquette and traditions. Welcome to The Good Manners Map with me, Monique Chambers, and my guest this week is all the way from Burma. We're talking to Yasmin. So, Yasmin, I know nothing about Burma at all, nothing. Can you tell us a little bit about the country?
Well, Burma is situated between Thailand and Bangladesh, so Thailand to the east and Bangladesh to the west, and China, Nepal to the north. So it's a country that very few people know about, but it's something that's sort of gaining in more exposure in more recent years, ever since the change in government. It was a country that sort of fell into darkness about 50 years ago with the military regime. And there was this form of socialism, which was very popular at the time, that was being instilled. But anyway, they sort of followed a fairly isolationist sort of policy. And I think a lot of people who would have visited Burma in the last 10 years or more would have found it somewhere locked in time. That's changing very dramatically. I was there in 2010, and the photos I see of Yangon, which was the capital, have changed dramatically. So things are moving. They're opening up for trade, and it has a way to go.
I can imagine, because of the geography, it must be quite stunning landscapes.
It is. It's got sort of mountains to the north, beautiful beaches along the southern coasts, very rich in natural resources. Teak, one of the best in the world. Lots of minerals and precious stones.
Okay. And is it predominantly a Christian country, or there are different religions?
It's predominantly Buddhist country. Okay. They follow Mahayana Buddhism, most of them. There are smaller minorities, like Muslim minorities. My family come from an Indian Muslim minority. My ancestors emigrated there, or were traders to the king in the early 1800s. Mm. And my father is, I think, fifth or sixth generation.
Okay.
And he belongs to a very tight-knit Indian community in Burma, in Rangoon. His family are now spread all over the world. So
with this, the sort of trading aspect of the family in the different countries that had influenced, has that had an impact on the cultures, on the traditions?
There has been a mishmash. One example that comes to mind is that, you know, you have biryani rice, which is Indian. That gained a lot of popularity. So you have little biryani restaurants, but they serve it with a sour vegetable soup, which is very Burmese.
Okay.
So perhaps the Burmese palate doesn't sort of cope so well with the richness of Indian food, but they sort of find there's a lot of Chinese influence as well.
Okay.
And the cuisine is, I suppose, if you were to, the closest equivalent would be perhaps Thai.
Right. Okay.
So you have a very complex flavors coming out in Burmese food, very strong on fish and pork, but really intense flavors.
And so are there foods that signify things that, I was going to say Christmas, but, you know, is there a time of year in the Buddhist calendar that then food becomes the main part of the celebration?
Well, the Buddhist calendar has a season of fasting.
Okay.
So there's a month where they don't drink anything from sunset to sunrise, which I think is really sensible, really, given that it's such a hot place. And there are certain foods that dominate or are significant in various festivals, but I couldn't tell you much more.
No problem at all. Is there something traditional that if we were to travel to Burma, we should look out for? Is there some sort of street food that is just the absolute, you haven't been to Burma unless you've had?
There's loads of street food. I think two things that are sort of most... Oh, my mouth is watering.
yes, should have brought samples.
one is a pickled tea leaves. So you get normal black tea, which is pickled, and that you make a salad out of that. So you have pickled tea leaves with dried beans and sesame seeds and oil and tomatoes and eggs. And that's eaten any time of the day.
Okay.
It's a favourite when it's cold and wet and miserable.
Comfort food.
It's really comfort food. Mm-hmm. And you might have a plain bowl of rice that you sort of have a spoonful of rice and the pickled tea. Another one is called mohinga, which is like a fish stew with noodles. It's a bit like a laksa.
Okay.
With noodles, again, very spicy. And that is a very popular street food. Interestingly enough, it's served for breakfast. Actually, it's served all day long. But it's not uncommon to go and have mohinga for breakfast. It's really pungent, strong fish
Wakes you
stew.
Up.
Yeah, it does. Keeps you going the rest of the day.
That's fantastic. So we're talking about starting the day. Is there a tradition that people would meet for tea at some point in the day, or for do you eat dinner as a family, or is it dinner would be a social occasion with friends?
Well, the day is very much sort of hit off by the priests. Buddhist priests go around collecting alms from the neighbourhood. So at dawn, it is quite customary for housewives to be cooking up a meal, freshly prepared, to give a tiny bowl full of food to their neighbourhood monk who would come by and collect literally a few mouthfuls from each household.
Okay, that's quite
sweet. And that's how the day starts. People are very sociable and very family oriented. So meals would be, I mean, as you asked me, I think, well, how else would you eat except for around the table as a family? So, yeah, family meals are very much the norm.
Big thing. And would people often invite friends to their home as well? Or do you meet friends out rather than at your home?
It is very sociable, very hospitable.
Okay.
Hospitality is really appreciated, very treasured in terms of customs. So when you meet somebody, and food is also very central. So when you meet somebody, you ask them, the first thing you ask is, you know, how are you? And the next thing you say is, have you eaten?
So ready to feed at any one time.
At any time, all the time.
So people would come to your home. What would they be expected to bring as a gift?
Nothing.
Nothing. Okay.
Their appetites. Mm-hmm. And if you don't eat well, then that would be sort of frowned upon.
So is there one of those traditions where if they eat everything on the plate, you just keep feeding them until they stop?
Pretty much.
Yeah. Okay. So I'd been warned about this in certain places, that it's almost wise to leave a small portion at the end so that people know now you've had enough to stop serving you.
It's fairly commonplace to have at least a couple of helpings of everything.
Okay. And so the traditional foods, like you said, mixed in with, is it regionally influenced?
There are sort of regional discrepancies. I mean, Burma is made up of a lot of ethnic minorities, and even geographically, it's very sort of spread out. So up in the mountains, bean curd, fermented beans are very common. In the south, there's a predominance of fish paste and fish sauces.
Okay.
So it is, the cuisine as a whole is very pungent, very, very strong flavours.
So when you have a wedding, for example, would that differ completely because of the sort of size and shape of the country? Or is there, the ceremony is pretty much the same, just the food might differ because of your location or your...
I think ceremonies are, well, I really couldn't comment that much, but the meal times, you don't actually have huge banquets, funnily enough. It's more a more modest sort of tea time or high tea or a lunch. So on one hand, whereas hospitality is valued and giving is valued, greed isn't.
Right. Okay.
So it would be untoward to really gorge yourself. So meals and tea would be, you know, wedding feasts would be sort of fairly light meals.
Okay.
The main point is to meet the couple, and it's actually quite formal. So you have the wedding, the religious ceremony, and then the the couple would sit on a sort of pedestal on a podium,
okay,
or a platform rather, and guests would go up and greet them and give them their gifts, and they would sort of, and then at the end of the reception they might circulate, but it's all a bit formal.
So these gifts, are they things for the house or are they
usually
different?
It's just money.
Okay.
So it's small
donations.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And then after a wedding, a while after the wedding, of course, when the first child would be born, mm-hmm, is there another tradition around that? Are there any ceremonies?
Well, there is a baptism, sort of a naming ceremony, and it's often traditional to gifts of gold. So if it's a little boy, it could be a ring or little buttons, gold buttons, or those really soft gold bracelets that are expandable.
I think
I've seen them in silver. So that would be common. But much like the Holy Communion within sort of Catholic cultures, there is a ceremony of ordination, if you like, at about 8. Young boys are shaved of their hair.
Mm-hmm.
And traditionally or symbolically, they would enter as novices into the monkhood.
Right.
Now, that is sort of, it's not done so much in practice anymore. So they would perhaps go into a monastery for 7 days. So it's just symbolic. But that is, if you like, the first, it's not even coming of age, but it's sort of like an initiation into the faith.
And so do young boys look forward to that process? Is that something exciting for them or is it something filled with trepidation?
I think it is an acknowledgement of having grown up, and it is quite exciting. Girls also pierce their ears.
Okay.
And there's a huge sort of celebration. There's a big reception that is held to celebrate that.
And that's the same sort of age, about 8 as well?
That's the same age, yes.
Okay. And then once they get to finishing school and moving on, is that just a general transition? No major celebrations
for all of that? No, there's nothing.
And what about getting engaged?
Engage, again, I wouldn't say they're massive sort of, it's fairly normal, really. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say there's anything out of the ordinary there. Weddings, as we've spoken about, but yeah.
Okay, so there's no other big ceremonies to look forward to, sort of, in a general lifetime.
No.
And so how about, I'm just thinking what would be, because it seems very, a sort of very gentle culture, like you say, the greed is not something in every other interview, it's all about sort of alcohol and dancing. So I'm guessing there's not much of the alcohol around, but is there a lot of dancing? Is there?
I don't believe it is at weddings. It might have changed now in sort of more modern times, but traditionally, no.
Oh, okay.
The sense of sort of composure and dignity is, at all times.
So does that translate into what people wear? So as a tourist, if you did go to Burma, are there things you should avoid wearing because you don't want to cause offence? Or
I think modesty is the key. There aren't any sort of hard and fast rules, but it's unusual for women to expose more than above their calves.
Okay.
And or their midriffs, and maybe perhaps not so much cleavage.
Mm-hmm.
So, reasonably covered up given the heat.
I'd be quite happy with that. There comes a point in time where you want to be modest. And is there anything else that we should be aware of being considered rude? Because obviously the Buddhist culture is not something we're used to every day in Malta. So
yeah.
How does one behave?
Well, within Burmese culture, and my husband has suffered greatly from this, there are a lot of minute rules. So if you're sitting at table, you never ever help yourself first and foremost to the meal that's being served. You always serve your elders first, so there's due deference there. Mm-hmm. If you are sitting in a group, it's not acceptable to cross your legs and have your feet up in the air.
Okay.
So that it would be in the eye line or around the face or above the head in any way, shape or form. So if you have, your mother-in-law sitting on the floor, you don't sit on the chair next to her so that you're above her.
Right. Okay.
So there's certain details of deference. There's a lot of deference given to older generations, a lot of respect there. And you don't say no very often.
So, Mum, can I have a new car? Maybe that wasn't the right question.
Direct confrontation as such is frowned upon. So any discourse is very indirect and it's very gentle. And sometimes it's really difficult to navigate as to what's happening in the undertones. And that's something my husband sort of scratches his head and says, what is going on? It's all in the subtlety. So there is a lot of subtlety in discourse there.
And is there anything else that we could learn from him, actually, as you know, foreigners to the shores? Other things that he, you know, almost tips that he would be able to share with us on, you know, if in doubt.
Just be quiet. You don't ask forthright questions. Not to be too direct. Mm-hmm.
And is that the same in business as well, in yes. trade? So everything is very,
very calm. Calm, set, subtle.
And so does that translate to things like everyday life on the streets, you know, the traffic, the walking around? Is it still very calm? And
it isn't. I mean, a city like Rangoon or Yangon is fairly crowded, and people are fairly overcrowded, so it's not uncommon to have people hanging out of doors and stuff on buses or riding up top or doing the same on trains. I once went on a train journey from Rangoon to Mandalay, and you know how you have the luggage racks mm-hmm. up top. So as night fell, people just hopped onto the luggage rack and settled down to sleep.
Fall asleep.
Yeah. I was like, how do you get up there?
And you just stayed sort of demurely seeing what was going on.
Yeah.
And that must be quite a long journey, actually.
It was. It also sort of stopped quite often. I'm not quite sure why, but I think the journey took twice as long as it was supposed to. Back then, things didn't work so well. I mean, basic supplies like water and electricity were issues, so...
We have those here, to be fair. So,
yeah. You know, so it's just varying degrees.
So in the streets, like you said, you'd generally be demure, you'd be modestly covered. Mm-hmm. Is that the same for the local population as well? They have. Yes. Is there any traditional dress that they would wear on a daily basis, or it's quite Western?
The most common is, and I think really sensible, both men and women wear sarongs.
Okay.
And shirts or women wear actually fairly short blouses that go with the sarongs. So yeah, they are fairly well covered and slippers or flip-flops.
And the sarongs are printed, I'm guessing, in different...
Yes, there's a selection of beautiful, beautiful hand-woven fabric that's available and very common. There's a silk weave called chait, which is a very... elaborate, very, very detailed and absolutely beautiful silk brocade fabrics. And there's also what I think we know as ikat, which is the silk brocade is textured, right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And ikat is not textured, but very intricate interplay of colors on silk as well. They also have a very special... silk that they produce from lotus sap. So you have the lotus flower mm-hmm. and there's this sort of sap that comes out of it, which they
can weave and spin.
Yeah,
wow.
they spin and, uh-huh. and weave, and it forms a very, very textured, very delicate but fairly well textured sort of fabric.
And is that something, again, to look out for while you're there, something
yes,
to be able
definitely.
To bring home and make a
fun. Oh, there's loads of, I mean, shopping is, there's good shopping there.
What else can we buy? Tell me.
There's lacquerware.
Okay.
Which is also really beautiful. It's everything that's made there is just so labor intensive, and people are very, very creative and very good with their hands. In the time I'm going back to the late 70s, early 80s here. What was popular were these household ornaments made from embossed tin plates. So you have very thin aluminium or tin,
right,
which is then embossed from the back. to form really intricate patterns or designs. And they didn't have the raw materials. So they used to repurpose toothpaste tubes, flatten them out, and sell these beautiful pieces of...
You know, so you would never know, actually, if you saw them, what their original... Yeah. So proper recycling, actually.
Yeah.
Very eco-friendly. So there's some ornaments and household things. These fabrics sound amazing. I'm going to go and look them up. And anything else we should sort of look out for in terms of fantastic sort of reminders of a trip?
I think there's beautiful inlaid work as well.
So wood or...?
Wood inlaid with sort of gold and all sorts of... I mean, it's sort of pretty bright. And they're beautiful sort of Buddha statues as well.
Are you allowed to take those out of the country now?
It depends. There's some that are sort of manufactured and of no historical value.
Ah, I see. That's the key then.
Yeah.
And what about, you were saying earlier, teak is something that's quite special.
Yeah, but that's not developed and produced into something sort of small and portable.
Right.
It's usually beautiful deck chairs or furniture. I mean, my grandparents had a whole upper floor made of teak.
Wow.
Way back when.
So tell us a bit about this sort of general everyday living. Is it people have normal working hours after you've had the monks come in the morning, then I'm guessing children off to school, then either going to work or running the household, then family dinner. So it's a typical day, is there, and then space for religion throughout the day?
People are fairly pious. They would either have a shrine at home or visit the local pagoda and have offerings and say their prayers. It's usually carried out by the women of the family. But in the evenings, I mean, the pagodas are usually places for social gathering as well. So at sunset, it would be quite common for there to be more people. And on the steps leading up to the pagoda, there's sort of markets of knickknacks, ornaments, things that people would use as offerings.
Right.
So buy as offerings to go.
So if you were a tourist attending a ceremony, is that okay for a tourist to go, obviously, assuming they're suitably dressed?
It is okay to go and observe and just sort of hang back. And actually, they're quite relaxed about taking photographs and things like that. Each act of...
offering or...
It's a fairly personal thing. So they would be saying their own prayers and making their offerings.
So there's nothing to see. There's no service.
There's no service.
Right,
it's not as organized. You might have priests who are giving a sermon, but it sort of all happens at the same... It's not so much it's not so orchestrated as a mass or service would be.
Okay. So are there other festivals that we should look out for as tourists visiting?
Well, the highlight of the year is the water festival, which happens around the second week of April.
Okay.
And that denotes the end of the Buddhist year. So it's bringing in the new year with a water festival, which cleanses all the bad stuff from the previous year and allows you to bring in the new year sort of with your soul and your body cleansed.
Ah, so it's a physical...
Oh, it is. It is. It's a huge water fight that goes on for 3 days. the streets are kitted out with fire hydrant hose pipes,
and
icy buckets of water, and you drive around. So you have one group who are hosing, and the other group who are receiving the hosing, and you drive around, and you literally get hosed down, and the whole country stops. There's music playing. It's sort of festa atmosphere. And it's really welcomed because it's the hottest time of the year.
Right, I was going to ask if it's...
temperatures are in the mid to high 30s, if not the 40s, and it's the hottest time of year.
So and this goes for 3 days, you said?
Yeah, 3 to 4 days.
And so wherever you are, you're at any chance of being hosed, or are there particular areas where...
You can have, you know, water fights in the house or kids will sort of come and attack you. And this is where all modesty and decorum drops and it's a free for all. In the past, my mother tells me that, you know, it was impolite to really go for the full frontal hosing. And, you know, young ladies were doused with a little bit of scented water down the back of their necks. Uh-huh. But that's no longer the case.
No longer the case. Fire hydrants at the ready.
Yeah.
That actually sounds really good fun.
It is good fun. It's actually quite painful. You have to sort of cover yourself with towels to protect your skin because it burns. The pressure of the water is so great that it burns. So for a country that has like no running water and electricity a lot of the time, all resources are are geared up so that, you know, all the pumps are working.
So the second week of April is not a good time to go if you want to have nice hot showers.
No. No. If you're hydrophobic, second week of April is not good. But it is a good fun, and the whole country actually shuts down.
Okay.
Everyone goes home or, you know, they celebrate out in the streets.
So it's just water fights in the streets the whole time. And anything else to celebrate the water festival?
They're sort of concerts and music and through the afternoon and into the evening. And then people settle down and they go out. A bit like the Festa here, they would just sort of parade and... Uh-huh. And check out the action in different parts of town.
So you get wet during the day, but there's no water at night?
No.
No. Okay.
After sunset, everyone calms down.
Okay. Well, I just think that sounds absolutely great fun. So it's, we have time to book our flights. But thank you very much, Yasmin. That's been really interesting talking to you about Burma. You've put a massive smile on my face. But yeah, thank you again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us on our journey around the world on the Good Manners Map here on Campus FM with myself, Monique Chambers, and the technicians Carmelo and Samuel. You can hear this programme on Mondays at 1:30 p.m, Thursdays at 9:30 a.m, and again on Fridays at 8 p.m. You can also download as a webcast from multiuniversitybroadcasting.com.